Okay. So this talk is intended to be for the people who haven't done phylogeny before, okay? Would you come in before we start? So there are one or two experts in the audience, I know, but I'm assuming that most people haven't actually done much phylogeny. So this is an introductory level talk, which is hopefully going to give you the background to understand what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. And so these are the sorts of things I'm going to say this morning. And I know a couple of weeks ago, Walter talked about a lot of these things. So I'm going to say nearly the same thing in my own way. And if we have another stab at it, hopefully it's gonna sink in. Okay. So if I get this wrong, then Walter will tell me off if I get it wrong. Yeah. Okay. So there are several different types of trees, and I want to think about what we imply when we draw a tree. And the simplest type of tree to understand is a rooted tree with a time axis. So time on this diagram goes from early to late. So the bottom here is the present day. And we can write times on each of the branch points in terms of the number of millions of years ago since that branch point occurred. So this is a rooted tree. The root is the earliest point on the tree. And we're implying by that tree that there was an ancestral species here which branched, and that this one branched later on, and so on. So that's a fairly straightforward type of tree, which is quite a strict type of tree, okay? We can make a slightly less, okay, well, not yet. I just want to say something obvious about trees first, before we move on to the next type of tree. That people say trees are like mobiles. That means if you hang them up by the roots, and you allow the horizontal things to swing around, then it doesn't make any difference. Okay, so this may be fairly obvious. If I swap those two around, it doesn't make any difference. If I swap these around, it doesn't make any difference. So you can imagine just hanging them up. Okay, so now we'll talk about the second type of tree, which is rather than drawing the branches proportional to time, we're going to draw them proportional to the amount of evolutionary change. So we're going to have some measure of how much change has happened along each branch. And what we get now, it's still a rooted tree, so this is still the earliest point, but the tips don't all line up anymore. And that's because if we just consider, say, C and D, there was a time at which this branch point occurred, so if we measure the lengths of these two branches in proportion to the time, then they have to be the same length. But if we measure them in proportion to the amount of evolutionary change, then they're not forced to be the same length anymore. So this is a less strict type of tree than what we had before. Now, even though the branches, there's no direct time scale on this tree, there is still an order of events implied by this tree. So I can still say that this branch point occurred earlier than this one, and that this one occurred earlier than this one. So the order of events is implied here, but there's no scaling of the diagram with time anymore. Okay. And I think this is probably one of the most useful types of tree, because it tells you things like which species have evolved the fastest. So I can tell from here that the rate of evolution along this branch to C is faster than the branch to D, for example, which is interesting information. But it also tells me the order of events, which is the most important thing I want to know in evolution, you know, what evolved from what. So that's probably the most useful type of tree when we can get it.
Excuse me, so, but you're not implying that all orders of time are implied by the tree. I'm thinking of, say, two branching events on different branches
okay.
that are not connected by a forward.
No, you're right. Okay, so you could have...
Those would be undefined, wouldn't they?
You could have this, and this would... You can't tell whether which of those two happens before. That's true. Okay, so this is called an unrooted tree, and the lengths of these branches now are proportional to the amount of change which is supposed to happen on each branch, and what you can't tell is the direction of the change. So I know how much change has happened from there to there, but I don't know whether evolution was going one way or the other. So that's an unrooted tree, and there's no time information at all on that. So just to say that the I've labeled A, B, C, D are species that we know. Those are existing species for which we have sequences. And then we have internal nodes, I and J, which we're inferring that those nodes existed, but we don't know what the species are. We don't know the sequences on those nodes. Now, when we've got an unrooted tree, usually we want to root it. And there are several different ways of rooting an unrooted tree. So if I, for some reason, knew that the root was on this branch here, then I could bend that tree round and I would end up with this. Okay? And that's the same tree as we had before. Whereas if I, for some reason, knew that the root was there, then I would give this one. And also I could put the root on the internal branch and I would get this one, okay? So in fact I could put the root on any of the branches in the unrooted tree and I would get something different. So these three are all different once I've put the root on, but they correspond to the same unrooted tree. And they imply different things about evolution, okay? I mean, this implies A and B are closely related and in the other cases they aren't. And most phylogenetic methods don't tell you where the root is, so you have to know in advance. So what you normally do is add a species which you know is the most distantly related species, and that's called the outgroup. So if I include in the set of sequences to be analyzed a species which I know is the most distant one, then I will know where to put the root. Okay. Right, now I'm going to take an example today and apply different methods to the same set of sequences. And the example I've shown is it's the mitochondrial gene for the small subunit ribosomal RNA. And ribosomal RNA is very often used in phylogenetic methods. There are very large databases of this gene. And I've picked a set of primates. And I've picked them because we're fairly sure what the correct phylogeny of these sequences is. This is a relatively simple example, although it turns out to have some interesting questions towards the end, hopefully, if we get that part. So the full length of the gene is about 950, and this is just a part of it. These are all primates. Let's start at the bottom. So we've got humans, chimps, gorillas, orangutans, gibbons. So we've got apes there. We've got baboons, which is, a baboon is an old world monkey. We've got two new world monkeys here. We've got two more primitive primates here. And then I've added a mouse. And I've added a mouse on purpose because I know that it's not a primate, and so that's going to be the outgroup. So one thing to think about then is before you can do phylogeny, you need to have a good alignment. Unless you use a method where you're doing the alignment and the tree building at once. So a topic for current sort of research is how do you do alignments and tree building at the same time, but that's more specialized than what I'm going to talk about today. So for traditional phylogenetic methods then, we're going to assume that we know what the alignment is before we start. That obviously means that you've got to put a fair amount of effort into getting your alignment right, because if you got your alignment wrong, you're going to be wrong right from the start. Okay. Now in this case, it's a fairly well conserved sequence. There are lots of bits. So the black shading are columns here which are exactly the same in all.
The chimp and the chimp have exactly the same sequence.
Which?
The chimp and pygmy chimp.
They may do in this bit. They don't all the way along. They may very well do here. You must have your glasses on there. Okay, so they're all different when you take the whole length, but they're not very different.
Have people looked explicitly at how the accuracy of the phylogenetics decays with improper alignments?
Probably. I don't.
Ned Goldman.
How do you define the improperness of an alignment, though? So, okay, when we do an alignment, we're implying that the columns are homologous, okay? I mean, we are implying that these U's here evolved into these C's, or, you know, for each column, we're implying that these are really the same part of the molecule. One good reason for using ribosomal RNA is because we have the structure is conserved, and the structure can help us get the alignment correct, okay? which is something I'll talk about next week probably. So there are large regions where it's conserved across the whole group. There are other regions where it's slightly variable, which are of course the informative regions. Okay, if there's no information if it's exactly the same. There's some information if there's a slightly variable column like these light grey ones. When you've got the very light coloured ones, there's rather little information because it's almost randomised. Okay, so sometimes people will deliberately look for regions which are very variable in their alignments, and they'll remove those variable regions before they start. Because variable regions are, in the first place, they're difficult to align, and in the second place, they don't have much information because it's more or less random sequence. So when you have a molecule which has very slow and very rapidly evolving parts of it, then people tend to remove the very variable bits. But I didn't, in this example, I didn't remove any of it, so I kept all of it.
I assume the dashed lines are gaps.
So the dashes are gaps.
Uh-huh.
There aren't very many gaps in this. Gaps are an awkward thing for phylogeny. You have to, when you're running a program, you have to read the small print about what they did with the gaps, because it depends what the method is and it depends what the exact program is. Basically, there isn't a very good way of dealing with gaps, because there isn't a very good statistical model for insertions and deletions.
This particular gap is for bases. So that means that it screws up completely the region frame, right?
I know, because this is RNA.
What?
This doesn't count for protein.
I see.
So this gap is interesting because it's clearly very informative, because all these are closely related. So it looks like a deletion has occurred at some point here. So all the primitive species, the true primitive ones have four there. There's the new world monkeys which have two, and then there's the old world monkeys and the eight there which have none. So that deletion is actually telling you something.
Does this particular alignment take account of structural information at all?
This one doesn't, no. But I could do, because I'm going to do the simplest possible thing, right? If I was really going to do phylogenies with this gene, I would do structure-based ones. But I'm not in this case. But you have to wait till next week to do that. So the first rule then of phylogenetics is you need to know what your species are. So we're going to start with an easy one. So what is this?
Gorilla.
A gorilla. Extra point if you tell me what its Latin name is.
Gorilla.
It's gorilla. And this one?
Baboon.
Latin name? So, having got our alignment then, we want to know how different are sequences. So we want a definition of distance between sequences. And the first thing you can think of is if you've got your alignment, you just count the number of sites which are different, and we can take, let me call it P. P is the fraction of sites which are different, which is 2, which is 3 out of 15, which is 0.2 in this case. So that's the Hamming distance, if you like. Now, the Hamming distance is not a good distance for phylogenies because it's not an additive distance. So an additive distance, what we're saying is, if I want to know what's the difference between a species down here and a species down here, then for an additive distance, I can add the distance going up to the ancestor there and the distance coming down to the other one. Okay? So that additivity of distances is a useful property of distances, and the Hamming distance doesn't have that property. It also doesn't increase linearly with time. So for example, if I had a branch here which was twice as long, I would like to have a distance which was twice as big. Okay. And the basic reason why P is not additive is because you can get more than one substitution per site. So I suppose that the ancestor was a G here, and that the sequences that we see have an A and a C. Okay. And there's been one mutation on each of those branches. We don't know G here, we know these two. So we look at them and we see that they're different. but in fact two changes have happened. So we can only see one change when two have happened. And in this case, we look at them, we can't see any changes, even though two have happened. So whenever there's been more than one substitution at the same site in the molecule, you can't tell that, and that's why P is not an additive distance. So we want to convert that P into a distance which is additive now. So let's think of a model of sequence evolution. In general, I want to say that Rij is the rate of substitution from state I to state J. Okay, let me just dwell on this word substitution, because a substitution is a change that we see. In other words, we look at two sequences and they are different, and we say there's been a substitution from one sequence to another. What we shouldn't say is a mutation, because a mutation is a change which occurs which can then be acted on by selection. Okay? So there are lots of mutations occurring. Most of them are bad mutations which are removed by natural selection, and therefore we don't see them. When we're doing phylogeny, typically we're looking at rather distantly related, we're looking at sequences from different species, which means that those are both functional sequences. Those sequences have survived the process of natural selection. So a substitution is the result of a combination of mutation, natural selection, and random drift. Okay, it's a change which gets through the evolutionary process. So what we want is to describe the rate of substitutions, not the rate of individual mutations. Right. The states I and J label the four bases. Okay, and I want to work out the Pij of t, which is the probability of being in state J at time t, given that the ancestor was in state I at time 0. So this is an ancestor in state I. At time t later, the descendant is in state J. And I'm going to suppose that it just satisfies that straightforward rate equation. So this is a matrix of rates. And if I know the numbers in that matrix of rates, then I can easily work out the probabilities, which are just sums of exponentials. And the exponentials are the eigenvalues of this rate matrix. Okay? So let's do the simplest one, which is called the Jukes-Cantor model. And it says that all the substitution rates are equal, and we'll call them alpha. And it assumes that all the base frequencies are equal, and so they're equal to a quarter, because there's four of them. And we can solve that rate equation, and there's basically only two functions to calculate. PII is the probability that the descendant is in the same state as the ancestor after time t, and it's this thing. So that starts at when t is naught, this is 1, okay, because they have to be the same. When t goes to infinity, this is a quarter. And Pij is the probability that the descendant is in a different state to the ancestor. And this starts off at naught, and it increases to a quarter. Okay. Now I want to calculate little p. Little p was the Hamming distance that we started with. I want to calculate little p in terms of this rate matrix. So p is the probability that two present-day sequences are different, given that their ancestor was t ago. So here we are. Here's two present-day sequences. The ancestor was a time t ago here, and I want to know the probability that these two are different. So the probability that they're different is 1 minus the probability that they're the same. And it's 2t there, because the total branch length between them is 2t. Okay? It's t going backwards there and t going downwards there. Now, the rate matrix is time reversible, which means that going backwards for t there and going forwards for t there is the same as going forwards for 2t. Okay? So this is why that's 2t there. Okay, so far so good. I've now calculated the Hamming distance in terms of the mutation rate and the time since the divergence. Now the next thing I want to calculate is the mean number of substitutions per site, and let's call it capital K. And it's 6 times alpha t. Now, think about it. There's a rate, whatever state I'm in, there's a rate alpha of going to each of the other states. And there's three other states, so the total rate of substitution away from where I am is 3 alpha, okay? But there are two branches. So there's 3 alpha times time along one branch and 3 alpha times time along the other branch. So the total number of substitutions per site is 6 alpha t. Okay? So now we say that this thing depends on alpha t, and that thing depends on alpha t. So we can eliminate alpha t. So we eliminate alpha t from those two equations, and we get this. And this thing called k is the Duke's contour distance. And it's positive, because we've got minus log of something which is negative here. So this thing is positive, and it just has a curve. This is a smooth curve, the best I could draw it, going up here. If p is small, then k is equal to p. And as p tends towards 3/4, this diverges upwards to infinity. Okay. So what we've done here is we've converted an observable distance p to an estimate of an additive distance k. Okay. And it's k that we're going to use for the phylogeny. So the point about this is that both k and p depend on alpha times t. And we don't know what alpha is, and we don't know what t are either. But we can eliminate the two things we don't know. Okay? So we don't know a time, and we don't know the rate of substitution very accurately either. But we can eliminate those things we don't know and calculate what we want to know, k, in terms of something that we can directly observe. and k is now increasing linearly with time if the mutation rate is constant. So this is going to be an additive distance. Does that make sense? There are a lot more rate matrices, and I just wanted to point out one of them, which is actually fairly often used. So this is HKY, which is Hasegawa, Kishino, and Yarlon. So this is a 4x4 matrix, which is we're substituting from this state to this state, okay? And this accounts for the fact that the frequencies of the four bases are different from one another, in general, and that the rate of transitions are different to the rate of transversions. So a transition is from a purine to a purine, an A to a G, or vice versa, or from a pyrimidine to a pyrimidine, which would be C to T, or vice versa. And there's a factor kappa here, and those four rates, which are the transition rates, and kappa is usually larger than one. So it's saying transitions happen kappa times faster than transversions. And this also, so the, if I let a sequence evolve according to this rate matrix, then I end up with the frequencies of the four bases being equal to those four frequencies there. So those are the stationary frequencies of the bases according to this model of evolution. So that's probably a more realistic model that we might actually use. I'm not going to use it for the rest of today. So for the rest of today, I'm going to go back to the simplest possible rate matrix, which is Duke's contour, and I'm going to apply that rate matrix to the example of the primate sequences.
So this is, you think, more realistic model, but can you think that the real model of what's going on in nature is not symmetric, but there are some limiting circles.
Circles. I've never seen anybody do a model with circles.
Not model, but what's going on in reality?
This is. It's like detailed balance. Okay, it's saying that the frequencies are stationary. Okay.
But it might happen that T goes to C, C goes to G, and G goes to T with some asymmetric coefficients.
It could, but unless you've got real evidence from biology that it does do that, it doesn't seem a very good idea to make the theory do that.
There was evidence that it was circular. I don't think there was evidence that it forced it to be non-reversible.
Petrov's model.
Yeah,
Petrov's system does.
Is it?
I would argue that Petrov's model, what he does is he assumes that it's circular by and non-reversible, and then fits the data that way. But I don't think he, for instance, saw whether or not it could be fit by a model like this.
He has this. He has this rate, right?
Right.
And it's essentially a non-detail balance.
What?
Yes, one rate is much higher than the other. You can't make a detail balance system out of it.
I would say that was my question for him, whether that could be adjusted by just adjusting the lines.
Well, just about every matrix everybody uses in phylogeny is a reversible matrix. It's a very handy property to have, and I don't think anybody has done very much theoretical work with any matrices which are non-spatial.
And it's worth pointing out that the reason for that is entirely computational. I mean, it's a very good nice convenience for most of the calculations to make it reversible.
I think there are biological reasons why it might be non-reversible, and that's when you've actually got something changing over the course of time. So, for example, if the GC frequency is changing during your phylogeny, from early to late during evolution, or something like that, then that's a biological reason for having a non-stationary process. That would be a time-dependent process. I'm not very convinced of circularity at the moment, but.
Just a question for the experts in the audience. In the literature, is it always do people always assume reversible process?
Certainly, my experience is that the case,
and it's not of a concern.
Well, when you know that an assumption may be violated somewhere, it's always an ought to be of some concern. But mostly, it works fine.
I just would like to make the observation that if detail balance is violated, then you add some sort of directionality. That means that you know that some substitutions are in one direction, prevalently in one direction, not in the other, even if you are at stationary state. So in this way, if the data effectively support the deviation from detail balance, then you have an extra hunch on the reconstruction of the and this apparently has not been exploited.
Yeah. Now, we played around with non-reversible models, actually, for HIV. And what we did was we didn't assume detailed balance. And we just saw what parameters came out of the likelihood optimization. And things to zeroth order obey detailed balance. Yeah, so we have played around with those models. And for the systems that we looked at, it didn't seem to help.
Just one more thing is that Petrov was deliberately trying to calculate the underlying mutation rate and not the substitution rate. That was his whole point. So this is actually the substitution rate.
Right, well.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
There is an interesting thing, though, that I don't know how it's related or whether it is or not, in terms of that for amino acids, there have been some evidence, which is somewhat controversial, of Stephen Bender, that at the short time, things are dominated by the amino acid triplet code, and at long time, they're dominated by the physicochemical properties of amino acids, which suggests that the ensemble average is not the time average.
But that's just two time scale. If we talk about the longer time scale, we'll forget about it.
Right, but it means that things are can't be time. Independent, you know, and that you could indicate
the coding system is such that there's not so much of a conflict, and it's pretty much optimized.
I know, but what he does is he finds
can we
that
go,
there
can
are
move forward from this point here.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's about time we had another one of those.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Is this your final answer?
Yeah.
The ring forward lemur.
Sure.
And that's another lemur as well. So this isn't in the sequence set, but it's just a nice picture of the lemur. Okay. So now we go back to our alignment, and we calculate that p. So we calculate the k, the Jukes-Cantor distance. So we're using the Jukes-Cantor model, and we're using that k formula that we had a couple of slides ago, and we work out the k's between each of those sequences. And this is one corner of the matrix because it won't all fit on. and I've highlighted, well, obviously it's a symmetric matrix because the distance from one thing to the other is the same as the distance the other way around, and the zeros along the diagonal because the distance from one thing to itself is zero. I've highlighted, this is the smallest number in the matrix, which is between pygmy chimp and chimp, which is 1.7%. Chimp-human distance is 3.5% here. This is a mitochondrial gene, and mitochondrial genes tend to evolve faster than nuclear ones. So if we were looking at nuclear genes, we'd probably see less than 3% difference between humans and chimps. The largest one in this part of the matrix is, well, 20% there. And the mouse primate distance was about 30%. That's not on this part of the matrix, okay? So the largest distances in this set are of order 30%. So we're going to take a matrix like that and use it as input to clustering. So clustering procedures work basically by a recipe which says you take the closest two clusters, you join them, you recalculate the distances between all the clusters, and then you keep going round and round until you've ended up with only one single cluster left. So initially each species is a cluster on its own, but the clusters get bigger as you go along until they're all connected. And this is a straightforward recipe. In other words, once you've connected two things and you've formed a cluster, you never do anything else with them again. You just go round this, you go round this loop n minus one times. You've got n species, and at each species, at each time you go through the loop, you go down by one until you end up with a single state. So you've got to go around that loop n minus one times.
Just to make sure I understand, what you call distance here is what you call capital K before?
Yes. Okay. So in my example, it's capital K, but in the terms of the method, it could be any distance. So from now on, it doesn't really matter how I calculated the matrix of distances, because the method is going to be the same. But for the example, it's capital K, yeah?
In the JC method, right?
Yeah.
So a cluster, what is the distance between a cluster and somebody is...
Right, so well, this is... So there's two questions, right? So capital K is the number of substitutions per site, which is our measure of distance between... So capital K is an amount of evolutionary change. It's a sensible distance. It's just how much change has happened along the branch, yeah? But then the second question, which I think is what you were asking, is how do you calculate distances between clusters, which is on the next slide, in fact. So there are lots of clustering methods, and they differ in the way in which you calculate distances between the clusters, okay? That's really what defines a method. And there's two methods I'm going to talk about. UPGMA, which is this thing, and nobody remembers what this is. So everybody talks about UPGMA, and there's neighbor joining, okay? So let's do UPGMA. So the definition of the distance between clusters, according to UPGMA, is that the distance between a cluster X and a cluster Y is just the average of the pairwise distances between the species A and B, where A is a species in X and B is a species in Y. So what this is the result that comes out of UPGMA with those sequences. And you start with the closest two, which were pygmy chimp and chimp. You calculate the distance between those, and then you recalculate the distance of this cluster of two from everything else. So the definition of the distance of this cluster from human is the average of the distance of human to pygmy chimp and human to chimp, okay? And if you had two clusters of two like this, the definition of the distance between these two clusters would be the average of the four pairwise distances that you can make by taking one from here and one from here. So the scale of these branches is proportional to the distances, and what we assume there's a molecular clock. In other words, we assume that all the species are evolving at the same rate. So whenever we've joined these two together, we say that the same amount of change has happened along this branch as this one. So the height of this node is one half the distance between pygmy chimp and chimp. Okay? Because by setting this equal to 1/2, the distance between those, we're implying that half the changes happened along this branch and half the changes happened on that branch. Okay? So what I mean by node height is from the present day's tips here to the position of the node. Okay? And the node height is always half the distance between the branches. Right. So this method forces the distances to be ultrametric. Now, if you remember what the definition of ultrametricity is, it's if you've got, take any three species, that defines three distances. And in our case, the distance from A to C is equal to the distance from B to C, and it's larger than the distance from A to B. So the rule for ultrametricity is that whichever three species you take, the two largest distances are equal. Okay. Now, on a tree like this, which assumes a molecular clock, this result is bound to be true. In your original input distances, it's not bound to be true. You hope that it's approximately true. And of course, this is a major setback of this model, because if the distances do not satisfy the ultrametric rule, in other words, if the real distances are far from being ultrametric, this method forces an ultrametric structure to the tree, and it gets the wrong answer. Right. So this method is often not used precisely because of the fact that different species do evolve at different rates, and you can't force them all to line up, all the tips to line up like this. Okay, but conceptually, this is the simplest possible method. So in our case, in fact, it doesn't do too badly. This is, well, what's wrong with that tree? Tell me what's wrong with that.
It's got the mouse closer to the landers than the landers.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I added the mouse because I knew that the mouse was supposed to be the outgroup, okay? And this is telling me that the mouse is closer to the lemur than it is to these, okay? In fact, we know that the mouse should be here, branching off like this, with all the primates coming together. So, but apart from that, in fact, I think this is the correct tree, apart from the position of the mouse. So it doesn't do too badly on this data. I mean, there's a fairly strong signal in this data, so.
One minor point, Adam, the mouse is probably the worst other mammal we can use because it seems to be evolving faster than the mouse, and rapid evolution is likely to reduce the consequences of relocating the root to your own brain.
Yeah, I didn't try it with another outgroup. I picked mouse for a reason, though, because the latest on the mammal phylogeny says that rodents and primates do go together closer than other things. But I agree that mouse is said to have a higher evolutionary rate, so maybe I should try a different outgroup.
You should produce higher distances to get the mouse further away from the rest.
Yeah.
So if you deleted the mouse, it would have a different structure of the tree.
If I deleted the mouse in this method, I'd just delete the mouse. It wouldn't make any difference at all. So this is not the final answer, right? We're going to get other answers coming up later on. So it doesn't really matter whether this is wrong or not for the moment. But I agree, it would be interesting to try the same set with a different outgroup just to see what happens.
What's the obligation to use an outgroup?
Right, this method produces a root, okay? Because it tells you that the root is where you join the last two clusters together, okay? So this particular method tells me where the root is. So if I didn't have the mouse, I would know that the root was between these two and everything else, right? Which would be fine. But in all the other methods I'm going to talk about, we don't know where the root is. So the reason I added the outgroup was so that I can put the outgroup at the root of the tree in all the other methods that we're going to do in a minute.
So what's the comment on Michael's question? Why mouse being evolving faster, why is it closer to one way?
You're more likely to have what they call homophasic changes. That is, a mutation occurring on rapidly evolving one, you have a fair likelihood as time goes by to accumulate parallel changes between them and adjacent ones, or especially other ones that are evolving fast. So that although they're separated, there's
if the same mutation is apparently occurring in two different lineages, then what one could imagine is that it happened before the ancestor tree. And if you've got a tree like that, where they're apart, then it can force the evolving one to pick as its choice of partner one that has gotten its mutations not as ancestral as the other two, but got them in parallel in their descent from their common ancestor. And these parallelisms are what makes everything go wrong. It's what destroys the additivity, using additivity in the sense of the four-point metric. It's those parallel and reverse mutations that destroy that activity and which give you the
parallel. Is it a compensatory? Is it something forced by selection?
It doesn't make any difference whether it's forced by selection or not. As long as it occurs, it louses up your interpretations. But it can be by neutral drift, it can be by positive selection. Either way, it's still parallel mutation in the reality which causes your reconstruction to put these things together because of those parallel mutations. Because it's easier to think of them as having occurred before their common ancestor.
I mean, here in this distance matrix, there must be that the distance between the mouse and some, and say this lemur, must be artificially short. So.
Well, when you said that, I thought on that slide said all of the distances were over 30. But it doesn't require that it be short. Because, in fact, the shorter it is, the less likely you are to have this phenomenon of parallel mutations screwing up.
Yeah. But if for some reason it's shorter distance to the lemur than it is to the other ones, then that it must be slightly shorter. Yes. I want to just show, and go back to the...
Individually short.
I want to go back to
this. Relatively less.
Because this is showing the sort of thing that's going wrong, I think. If you remember, out of these, the baboon is the most distant. So the baboon is on a line, and then all these are together in a group. So that means that if the matrix is ultrametric, then the distance from the baboon to everything else should be the same. So all these in the top row here should be the same, and they are approximately the same, but not exactly the same, okay? So, because they're only approximately the same, the method has room to go wrong. I mean, and I haven't got the bit with the mouse on there, but that's what's happening with the mouse. I mean, there are some fluctuations in these distances, and those are leading it astray and telling it to put them with the lemur and not. Yeah.
Maybe can it be caused by the fact that mitochondria is not exactly what defines. Species. I mean, the mitochondria is some sort of it's like a car battery for the car. You can change the models of the cars, and batteries are changing. But then this car, the Volkswagen and golf car, they have the same battery. Use the same battery. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the thing about mitochondria is they're supposed to be maternally inherited, which is actually a simple means of inheritance. So you'd expect phylogenetic trees to work fairly well for mitochondrial sequences because you've got no problem with recombination.
Function, yeah? which plays inside the cell, it's not very specific.
But in this model, the mutations are random. There's no selection. So it's looking at the random drift of the sequence. It doesn't matter whether it's mitochondria or something else. It's just looking at random drift. So in this model, there's no such
thing as selection. In this model, yes, but you say it's good for tandem, but maybe it's not.
No, but for the model, it is. So it doesn't make a difference whether you use mitochondria or anything else.
Mm-hmm. So lots of people use mitochondrial sequences for phylogenies. You're not guaranteed to get the same answer if you use a different sequence. And also, just because you've got this is a gene tree, if you like. We're doing the evolution according to one gene. And it doesn't necessarily follow that the branching pattern of the species is the same as the branching pattern of the gene. But you hope it usually is, yeah?
But if you had a change in function, for instance, then that means that this model would be a rather bad model. And things would be a lot more complicated.
But it has to be said that there are lots of more complicated models that people use in phylogeny, but they're not really geared to this idea of changes in function and positive selection. The models are kind of assuming that you've got a balance between neutral mutations and deleterious mutations. And you're assuming that the deleterious mutations are eliminated and the neutral ones get through. So the process you're describing is the accumulation of the neutral changes. If there were particular selected changes on particular branches, that would mean every branch was different and evolving in a different way in some, yeah? I mean, you hope that that's not going to affect the answer very much, because you can't really account for that.
Or maybe at least that it's affecting only to the degree that the overall rate is changed.
Okay, so it has to be the same on every branch. If selection is very peculiar, and peculiar fast bursts of positive selection are going on in one branch, then it messes things up. Yeah? Okay, so the second clustering method, which is called neighbor joining. These green dots are the original species, okay? And I know the distances between all those green dots. And what I want to do is I want to take two nodes, which are neighbors, connect them, produce a new node called N, and go to this situation here. So in this situation, I've got one new node, and then I've got two old nodes which are colored red, and I can forget about the red nodes from now on. So what I've done is I've added one new node and removed two old ones, and I'm back to a situation now with one fewer node than I started with. So basically, if I just take any three, I'm going to connect I and J, okay? But then let's consider one further node, K, and I've got three distances between those three species. So I've got three simultaneous equations, because I'm assuming additivity now. So the distance from I to N plus the distance from N to K is equal to the distance from I to K. Okay? So that's three simultaneous equations. Solving those, I can work out the distance from N to K. Okay? So that's fine. And I can do that for each of these unconnected nodes K out here. Okay? This formula works. Now, solving those three, I can also get something for D, I, N. I need to know how far I is from the new node, and I can solve those three simultaneous equations. But then the problem with that would be that I'm determining the distance from I to N based on only one particular node K, and I don't want to just include one particular node K, okay, because there's nothing special about that particular K. So what you do is you define this thing RI, and RI is basically the average of the distance of I to all the other nodes K, and RJ is that. And then the best estimate of DIN, according to this, is this thing, okay? And this uses the Rs. In other words, it uses information about how far I is from all these other unconnected nodes, not just any one particular one, okay? So this is... it's the best job you can do of solving a set of simultaneous equations when you've got more equations than unknowns.
Is this the same result as if you were to repeat the procedure many times for different k's and just average?
Yeah, this is basically... So if I just solve the first three...
Right, and then you do it for each k, and you get a different DI k's, and then you DIN's, and
you average. That's right, because here, what I would get for one k, I would get DI k minus DJ k. And then if you average that, you get those R's.
I see.
Is it really the best job one can do? I mean, if I think, for example, of your example with the outgroup, then and I were to calculate this procedure within sort of one set of more closely connected species, shouldn't I sort of discard the ones that are very far away in applying this sum over K? I mean,
maybe.
The guy Bill Bruno at Los Alamos has done something called Waiver, which is a very complicated way of basically choosing the pairs and doing that, taking account of the variance of them, the variance of the
different ones. There are improvements on that, certainly. This is the way that neighbor joining does it, and it's a reasonably sensible way of doing it, but that's not to say there's not a better way. Right? And so the thing about clustering methods is there's no criterion by which to judge the answer. Okay, So the advantage of clustering is there is a very well-defined recipe for constructing a tree. And it's sensible in some way. I mean, this is a plausible way of doing a tree construction. But then at the end, you've got no rule by which you say this is the best tree according to some rule, right? So the ways we're going to move on to in a minute is ways of actually comparing trees and having a criterion by which you judge them.
Doesn't the RJ matrix come into account in choosing the pairs also?
Yeah, well, I haven't said that yet. So the only thing we haven't said is why did I pick I and J here rather than any other two? Yeah? And I pick them because I know they're neighbours. Right? So a neighbour on an unrooted tree, two neighbours on an unrooted tree are species which are connected by a single internal node. Yeah? So these two are neighbours, but this is not a neighbour of that one because there's more than one internal node to get from here to here. Yeah? So in order for this to work, I have to know that I and J are neighbours. So the first thing you might think is I just take the closest two distances. But that doesn't work because you can get things like this. So, right, if I have a funny shaped tree like this, then these two species are very close to each other, but they're not neighbours. So neighbour joining actually requires me to choose this one and this one because those are neighbours. Yeah. Now, if I just look at the matrix and take the closest two, then I get the wrong answer if the tree looks like this. So now, there's actually a rule. In fact, that was on there. So this is the problem, right? So I need to know how to get around that. And the way that neighbor joining gets around it is it calculates a transform distance, capital D, and capital D is little d minus ri minus rj. And there's a theorem that says that if your input matrix, little d, is additive, then this capital D, then it says that if you choose the pair of species for which capital D is smallest, then those are bound to be neighbours, okay? So in this situation, the capital D would be smallest for these two and not for these two, okay? And that's a theorem which is provable if your input matrix is additive, yeah? So if your real matrix is approximately additive, then this is going to give you the right answer, okay?
Is this good time?
Well, let's do the results of neighbor joining and then have the break, yeah? Right, so this is the results of neighbor joining. This is an unrooted tree, okay? So neighbor joining doesn't tell you where the root is. And now what I want to do is put the root on. I'm going to say that I know that the mouse is the outgroup, so let's put the root on that branch. And then we get this. Okay? Which is now the same topology as before, except that the mouse is outside. And I've assumed that the mouse is out. So I put the mouse to be outside, okay? I believe this is the correct topology. All these branches are in the same order as they were before. Okay, the method hasn't told me that mouse is outside, but I'm prepared to assume that.
Yeah. What are these numbers?
Well, do you want to do that before the break? Numbers before the break or after the break? After the break. Okay. So. The question is, what are these numbers, right? And they're called bootstrap percentages, and they're a measure of reliability of the different branch points on that tree. And so the higher number, the better. And there's lots of 100% numbers on this tree, which is good, okay? So there's lots of reliable points. And I'm going to explain how we calculate the percentages in a minute, but I just want to look at which bits are reliable and which bits are not, firstly. And you can see that the lowest point is this 47% branch point here. That corresponds to this meeting point of these three So you can see that there's a very tiny internal branch there between the point where the tarsian and the lemur meet and the meet the mouse there. So that internal branch is very small. And when you get small internal branches, it's difficult to estimate them. In other words, you're drowned by the uncertainty in the random process. Okay? So because of this rather close meeting point here, it means that this branch point is rather unreliable. And let's think about, there are two alternative things that could happen there. You could have mouse followed by lemur, followed by tarsia, followed by everything else, yes? Or you could have the same with lemur and tarsia the other way round, okay? Or you could have what I've drawn, which is lemur and tarsia and, you know, everything else down here. Okay? So those are the alternative things that could happen at this point. And because of the uncertainties in the distances, rather difficult to tell the difference between those. There's another uncertain point, which is at the point where the humans, gorillas and chimps meet there. Okay? And that corresponds to an 84% bootstrap rule in this case. Yes, and virtually everything else on here is pretty certain.
And if you use this other distance that you're speaking about, does it keep this the
numbers change? I don't know is the answer.
What is the point?
Usually not. If it's difficult with one method, it's difficult with another method as well. So some methods are slightly better than others. Yeah.
But I guess it's one of the prejudices of phylogeny that people are trying to force an order on this kind of very, very short internal branches, while the speciation is itself a process that requires a certain amount of time. At some point, it just gets blurred. And so maybe it's not even a very good question what the precise order mm-hmm. is for such short events. It's more like a string theory diagram.
There are two reasons why this can happen. One is because really you did get a radiation of species at the same point. And the other is because your distances are approximate and things go wrong, yeah? So, in the case of gorillas, chimps, and humans, this probably was a fairly rapid radiation, yeah? So there probably wasn't, these branches are really short. In this case, I suspect it's because of uncertainties in the alignment and things like that. These are really rather different to one another, and when you get things like that occurring a long way back in the past, they probably mean uncertainties in the method rather than
real. It's a separate issue of whether you have a precise radiation process which you know only approximately, or the process itself may be fuzzy. Mm-hmm. Speciation doesn't happen in microseconds or two things, but right. So it takes, I don't know, so many times to develop that.
This is a gene tree, right? In this case, there is a divergence time between these. This is a mitochondria. The entire mitochondria is going to have one specific tree. Now, whether that matches the quote species tree, mm-hmm. it's true. That's a very, very good point. But in this case, just in terms of the method, if it worked perfectly, ought to be able to divert. There's a statistical problem here that has nothing to do with the
species tree. But even if it's a gene tree, I could argue that at some point, maybe it's equally good to have this or that, and this can coexist for a while, in which case you have
fuzziness again. Yeah, but you're looking at a historical thing, so there's a coalescence. There's no recombination.
Yeah, but maybe at some point that there's a sort of two-part population. One has this sort of a A here, the other has a C here, and they coexist for
a while. Yeah, but I'm saying that you're looking at a historical process, so even if at one point two things existed, at this point, this far forward in time, only one of those surviving alternatives will have existed.
Yes.
So what you're saying is true when you're comparing a gene tree and a species tree, that is, some things will have multiple copies and different things. So if you look at one gene versus another gene where there's recombination in between, you'll get differences. But in this case, with one non-recombining mitochondria, that won't be the case.
I wonder if you're saying that there is a definite latest common ancestor.
Yeah, there's a history to these sequences.
One you should recognize that it's sort of an article of faith on the part of the biologist But if we had a good method, it's a matter of getting enough data. And then when you see something that's very close down there, it isn't necessarily that it's unresolvable. It just means the data that you have don't resolve it. But we feel that we get enough data.
Yeah.
And there have been cases where the whole genome would not be enough.
But that's precisely the question I was asking, whether you have enough data you will resolve it, or the thing itself is unresolvable.
May I make a suggestion? We're going to have the third week of this. The third week is supposed to focus on these type of questions.
So how do I calculate those percentages then? And what you do is you resample columns from the original sequence alignment. So here's the original sequence alignment, and the dots mean that it's the same as the one above, okay? The dots mean it's the same as the top sequence, okay? So what you do is you make a set of random sequences such that each column in the random sequences is a randomly sampled column from the real alignment. And when you do that, sometimes you sample the same one twice. Sometimes the column gets picked twice, and sometimes the column doesn't get picked at all. So the set of columns you have in the random sequences is not the same as the real set, okay? Now, you hope that by doing that, you do that, and you repeat your method on the random sequences. And because you've messed about with the sequences a bit, you're going to change the distances a little bit. So you're going to add some random noise onto the distances. And if there's a strong signal in the data, then that extra random noise that you add won't change the order of branching. But if there's a rather weak signal, and there's short internal branches and things like that, then by adding the noise to it, you change things around. Okay? So what you do is you do lots of different sets of random sequences, at least 100 and maybe 1,000 of them, and you do your method on each of those, and then for each clade in your real tree, you calculate the percentage of times that clade occurs in the set of trees from the random sequences. Yeah?
You're going to define clade?
So a clade is a set of species that descend from a common ancestor. So for example, well, let's do it with the real one. So lemur and tartu is a clade here because it's a set of species that descends from there. Yeah, these two are a clade. Gorillas, chimps, humans are a clade, yeah? But baboons and gibbons aren't a clade, because baboons and gibbons have this common ancestor there, but there is no point on there which is the ancestor of gibbons and baboons, which is not the ancestor of other species as well, yeah?
Right. But baboon, gibbon...
Baboon, gibbon, orang, and all of those together is a clade, yeah? Right. So, or a monophyletic group is the other word, right? Right, so there were lots of hundreds on here, right? The only places that were unreliable was this point and this point in that case.
Is there an 84?
There's an 84, yes.
So 84 is frequently sort of acknowledged by some biologists because Hillis, who was coming, had shown that the bootstrap values don't match the distribution that you would expect, in that at somewhere around 70-75%, the bootstrap value is an underestimate of the probabilities that it would be in that way.
I'm going to compare the posterior probabilities with the bootstrap values later on. So there is an issue of what does an 84 mean, right? Does it mean that you're 84% confident that this is right, and you don't know? I think basically the answer is nobody knows exactly what bootstrap numbers mean, but the bigger they are, the better. the ranking is a sensible ranking, yeah? What you are not quite sure of is how low can you go before you stop believing them, yeah?
The problem with the bootstrap is there's a lot of statistical theory which says what the bootstrap values actually mean, but in this context you don't have the main assumption that all the statisticians use, which is the independence of the columns. So So here, we don't have independence of columns. So the bootstrap is a statistical method on which there was all this theory on which you could actually give error bounds completely falls apart. And it's very good what you said before, which is you can consider it as a perturbation method.
Yeah.
That is, it's a perturbation method, and you want to see how much the tree is going to vary.
So everybody does bootstraps, and they're very useful. The problem with them is knowing exactly how to interpret a given number. Yeah? And a rule of thumb is that people tend to say if it's more than 70, then it's okay. And if it's less than 70, then we don't. I mean, 70 seems, I thought that was the magic number. For what? Yeah. Yeah.
I missed this. So what do you do? You take a one column and a scramble it?
Okay. Oh, no.
You pick the first column in your random set is a randomly chosen column, which just happened to be this one, right? So I take that column as it is and don't do anything else with it other than copying it from there to there. Yeah?
Oh, I see.
And then
so
you do
all the columns.
Right. And you create an alignment here at the same length as the first one. Each one is a randomly chosen column from the first, from the original column.
Actually, this method of adding noise is a good illustration of the previous point, because it's like making a tree is approximating a quantum process by a classical set of trajectories, and those make only sense if the distance is larger than the quantum calculations.
In some way, this noise that you're adding is supposed to be of the same size as the noise you would expect to get anyway due to the randomness of the mutations. Yeah. So.
This is the wrong set.
Come on, what's this?
Marmoset.
Somebody says. Can we have a vote on this? What is this?
Does the vote help to make the tree also?
It's the out group.
Not cute, that's for sure.
Looks like that is a marmoset. So that's a new world monkey, okay? There are lots of marmosets. This is another marmoset, which is nicer. But I could only find the sequence for that one. That was right. So I want to think about reasons why trees are never exact. So let's take the ideal world physicist. This is the ideal physicist world, right? Uh-huh. So supposing I know the tree, I know all the branches, and I know the model of evolution the sequences obey. So you can simulate the evolution of sequences along that tree according to a known evolutionary model, and what you end up with is a set of sequences on the tips of the tree which obey the model that you're talking about. Yeah? Then you can take those sequences and go backwards with your method and reconstruct the tree. And the point is you'll never get exactly the right answer that you started with. And that's because substitution events are a stochastic process, so that, suppose this is the real tree, and they're supposed to be on average the same number of mutations along there as along there. Now, on average, that's true, but in actual fact, in any one simulation of this evolutionary process, there will be some more on one branch than the other. So even though you know exactly the right evolutionary model and you know the right, you can never get back to the right tree. That's the point. Okay, now. This is, in some ways, you can think of that as a finite size effect. Because if you have very long sequences, then you'll get the numbers of substitutions occurring on each of these branches will be more and more close to the average value. Okay, and so the method gets more and more reliable as the length of the sequences increases.
So in this model, would the bootstrap fulfill the statistics assumptions?
Well, no, because
there's
another thing to add, which is the independence of columns.
Okay, but in the ideal, this is true. So we're still in the ideal world, though, then there would be independence of columns, and then if we had an infinite sequence, then we would get 100% bootstrapped. I think,
But the independence of columns somehow is something which biologists mostly want to assume.
No, okay.
I mean, that's not
there
in the ideal world.
No, I know. Well, so here we are. This is the real world, right? We haven't got to the real world yet.
Even in the ideal world.
The ideal world, you can make it anything you want.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, let's do the real world. We don't know the correct model of evolution, so that when we're constructing the distances, we make errors, okay? The model of evolution includes other things which we haven't talked about yet. In other words, there may be variability of rates between sites in the sequence, which we didn't account for so far. There may be variability between rates of evolution on different species or between different times during evolution, and we've assumed all those things were constant. But then there's a big problem with saturation of mutations. That means that when sequences are very divergent, there will be several mutations at every site, and then we really can't tell what's going on. And basically, it's this point in the curve here. We have this curve of K against P. As long as we're down here, we're more or less okay. When we're up there, we're in a mess, because a small fluctuations take you in that direction, and that gives you large errors in that direction, which is what you're using. Yeah. So that problem is called saturation of mutations. Evolutionary radiations may have occurred in a short space of time, which is what Michael said. And then there may be recombinational horizontal transfer, which means that your sequences don't obey a tree anyway. Yeah. So there's lots of problems in the real world, but I guess the point, in some ways, this is the point I want to make, that even in the ideal world, when you know exactly the way the species have evolved, you know the model of evolution of the sequences, you still are subject to fluctuations due to the random nature of the evolution. Okay, so now I want to think about criteria for judging trees. There are n minus 1 over 2 different pairwise distances, right? In an unrooted tree, there are only 2 n minus 3 branches. And in an ultrametric tree, there are n minus 1 node heights. So you've got this number of constraints to satisfy, and you've only got this number of variables, depending on which method you use, which is obviously much, much less. So there's no way you're not guaranteed to get at exactly the right answer, okay? So if we consider neighbor joining, it produces an additive tree that approximates to the data matrix if the data matrix is approximately additive, okay, in the first place, yeah? But there's no criterion for defining the best tree. What there is a rapid algorithm for construction of the tree, right? So you get a tree very fast. Let's compare that with what's called Fitch-Margolyos method, which is to define a measure of non-additivity of the tree. So I'll call it E for error. If this is the distance matrix, and this is the matrix measured between the species on the tree, okay, assuming that it's an additive tree, then this is a measure of the error between the tree that you're constructing and the data that you're putting in the first place, and it's scaled relative to the distance. So this is like this is the square of the relative error summed over all the branches. Okay. So if the distance matrix is exactly additive, then it's possible to find a tree for which these are all the terms in this sum are exactly zero. If in a real data matrix they're not exactly additive, but you can find a tree for which this is as small as possible. So that is a well-defined criterion for judging two trees. But the disadvantage is there's no well-defined method for constructing it, okay? So what you have to do is you have to search lots and lots of trees until you find the one that minimizes that, okay?
So if the data are not completely additive, how well does the neighbor joining tree usually do with respect to E?
It's not a very well-defined question, because you have to know in what way they're not additive. I mean, you could test that with simulations by constructing non-additive distance matrices by some method, right? And then the answer that you get depends on what method you use to construct. You have to have a sort of real world, which is one step higher up than the test method, in order to answer that question. Yeah? People have done that sort of thing. Yeah?
one just particular, I'm sure one particular way neighbor joining breaks down is that you have the long branches, right? And because you're doing that RIJ matrix to choose the next pair of nodes, when you have a lot of things that are very, very far away, those have big fluctuations, right, in their distance between these localized nodes. So if you're trying to settle a localized problem here, those big fluctuations will tend to mess up this localized problem.
Quickly, what's this? I'm in the way. You've got them all right so far, haven't you?
Okay.
No, you got one wrong. You got one wrong. Yeah. So how do we search tree space? Basically, you can think of any method you want to mess about with trees and see if it works, right? There's no rule for this. Yeah? You can just change the tree in any way you want to and keep trying lots of things. Typically what people do is they take this, do what's called nearest neighbor interchange. In other words, they take two branches or two subtrees which are connected by an internal branch and they swap them. Or they take one subtree, like the blue bit, disconnect it and reconnect it somewhere randomly otherwise. Okay? So there are lots of programs that do this, and you could it doesn't really matter, basically. This is just to say that there are lots of different tree topologies, so you can't possibly search them all. Even for a relatively small number of species, the number of topologies is very different. It's very large, and so you have to guide your search by some criterion. In other words, basically you're doing a hill climbing thing. You have your criterion that tells you how good each tree is, and you're trying to move towards better and better trees. So there's an issue of whether you get trapped in local optima and things like that. Okay. But there are lots of programs available which do this, basically. So it's a reasonably solved problem.
Is there, do people talk about like a local version of tree making, like a subset of data maybe not to a tree and another part could be just junk? Like, if you try to say make the best tree, taking a subset of data, is there such a concept?
And when you have some things that aren't evolutionary related that you want to be able to exclude, or?
Well, I guess, there could be data that's on the fringe that you really don't want to put too much, say, confidence on it if you take those out and make it, at least, okay.
The problem is the method isn't decomposable. It's been proved that it's NP complete, whether you do maximum likelihood, whether you do parsimony, which is equivalent to spinor trees. So because it's NP complete, you can't decompose the problem into smaller ones and reassemble.
Yeah, that means that theoretically you can, but practically you can't.
I mean, practically there are things like monkeys and then there's the mouse, so you would like to sort of solve that problem first and then connect it to the more distant ones and do that later. So there is a hierarchy in the data in some sense. That's
so next criterion for judging trees, is maximum likelihood. And it just says that you calculate the likelihood of observing the given sequences on the tree that you're testing. Okay? So let's suppose we've got two species with known sequences on the tips of the tree. I can calculate a function which is the likelihood of there being a base X at this point, given the length of these two branches, right? Which is just the probability of going from X to an A in time T1 and from X to a G in time T2. This is the likelihood of the base X being on this point, right? Now, if I'm considering a more general case of an internal part of the tree, so this is there's this whole subtree coming down from this point Y, and I've already worked out the likelihood of a Y being there by this sort of a rule, and I've worked out the likelihood of a Z being here. Well, now I can work out the likelihood of an X being there by summing over all these possibilities, okay? So what this is a recursive rule for constructing the likelihood of any base occurring on any given branch. So I can keep doing that, working up from the tips to the root, and then I have to sum over all of the possible things that could occur on the root. Okay. So having done that, I've got now the likelihood of that site. And here's where I have to assume that the sites are independent, so I'm going to assume that the likelihood is the product of the likelihoods of the sites, so the log likelihood is the sum of the log likelihoods of the sites. So everybody talks about log likelihoods because they're summable over the sites. Yeah?
So P is what you calculated before by this bootstrap method?
No, no, P is the mutational matrices.
So how do you know what P is if X is
you solve it according to your... The PIJ matrix.
Right, the original PIJ matrix. Yeah. I thought, so that's known even for the internal nodes? If I is an internal node.
This is a function. This is a function which came from solving the eigenvalues of the rate matrix.
He's assuming it's constant over the tree and every site at this point.
I see. Assuming it's constant. That's the thing.
This is the description of my evolutionary process, which I've got a PIJ function, which is the probability of going from a state I to state J in a time t, and I've solved that's the model I'm using, which I know. Yeah.
Why is there summation with
the? Because I don't know what these are. So these were tips, and I did know what they were because they were real sequences. So from tips, I can go up to an internal node, right? But now I want the likelihood of the whole tree. So in general, I have to be able to do it recursively by taking two... These are internal nodes on which I don't know what they are, so I have to sum over all the possibilities on that node. Give me all the possibilities on the next node.
But you already have a topology.
Already have what?
Yeah, but it's sum between the base pairs, not the topology tree.
He's the first
But types you also don't know, right? You may know that they're equal to each other, but you know.
The times may or may not be equal to each other, but the point is I'm testing a tree. So I'm giving you a tree with specified branch lengths, and I want to know how good it is. Mm-hmm. Right?
But
so for any given trial tree with trial t's, I can calculate the likelihood, and then I have to generate lots of trees and see which one's the best. Yeah?
Times are uniquely determined by your tree by being essentially an apple tree. Lengths of your branch.
If this was a rooted tree, then those would really be times and they would be two equal times, right? But if they're not, if it's an unrooted tree, then really those are lengths of branches and they may not be equal. Yeah? Okay. Well, so passing the criterion. I'll try to do it quickly. It says explain the data in the simplest possible way with the fewest arbitrary assumptions. And it really comes from phylogenies that were done with morphological characters. So we think of a morphological character, let's say tetrapod limb or something. So lots of species share the fact that they have four legs and that the bone structure in their limbs is the same and so on, right? So that's a derived character, okay, which I shall call one. So let's suppose species C and D possess this character that I shall call 1, which is absent in A and B, and we'll call that the absent state 0. On this tree, I put C and D together. So what we're implying by that is, well, that the plus represents the evolution of this derived character, which occurred once at this point. Okay? So it occurred once here, like the tetrapod limb occurred here, right? And then all these species down here have these tetrapod limbs because they all evolved from the ancestor which had it. Yeah? On the other hand, if I was to propose this arrangement of species, then in order for C and D to have it, it would have had to have evolved at this point. But B doesn't have it, so the star is a loss of a character here. So this tree is more... I have to propose two events in order to explain this arrangement of species, whereas I only have to... propose one event to do that. Now, on this tree, it would have had to have evolved twice independently. Okay, so parsimony says choose this tree because it's the simplest possible explanation that this evolved once. Okay, so you could so people use this with morphological characters, and it works quite well if you have well-defined characters. So if you have something that is really easily spottable, and you can tell whether your species has it or not, and if it's a rather unlikely thing, then you can be pretty sure that it did only evolve once, and therefore this method makes sense. So one character divides your set into two subgroups, the haves and the have-nots, yes? And what you hope is that if you've got many different characters, they're informative about different parts of the tree. So you can get your whole tree if you have sufficient number of characters.
So kind of the regime where the Hamming distance would be a reasonable approximation to the thing, because no double processes are allowed.
This is kind of logical as long as you know what your characters are. And it's more logical for morphological characters than molecules. So the next thing is, what do people do with molecules? And they do the same argument. So I've got five species here. And the letter in brackets is supposed to be, what DNA base do I have at one side, right? So I've got three species with a T and two species with a G. And if I put them on this tree, then there's one mutation that has occurred on that branch, okay? Whereas if I've swapped C and T around there, now I have to propose two mutations in order to have this arrangement. So parsimony says choose this arrangement of trees rather than that one because it involves fewer mutations. Okay. Not all sites in the alignment are informative by parsimony. So for example, supposing I have one, these four are all T's, but this one is a G. Then I can, on this tree, I can put the mutation there. But if I swap those around, well, now I can just put a mutation there. So in fact, when there's only one which is different from the rest, I can always put a mutation on the branch that goes down to that particular species. So that's a non-informative site. So to be informative, a site must have at least two bases that are present at least twice. That's the rule. And then, so what you do is you calculate all the sum of the total number of mutations on all the sites, and that's the criterion for judging the tree, and you take the one with the smallest number of mutations. So that's what people do, and lots of people use parsimony. So let's consider parsimony sort of versus maximum likelihood. Parsimony is fairly fast because there's an efficient algorithm to calculate the parsimony score. So the parsimony score is the number of mutations required. And if I give you a topology, there's an efficient algorithm to calculate the number of mutations required. Yeah. So if you compare that with maximum likelihood, even if I give you the topology, you've still got to maximize the branch lengths and the parameters in the rate matrix. So even doing the maximum likelihood calculation within one fixed topology is a fairly complicated optimization problem, whereas doing parsimony with a fixed topology is a relatively quick one. Yeah? Parsimony is approximation to maximum likelihood when mutations are rare events, which is more or less what you said there.
Rare events are equally likely. In other words,
you can cut
biases between transversions and transitions.
Yeah, you can account for that with parsimony. So you can vary your score. You can count some things worse than others in parsimony, which is a bit the same as like saying transitions and transversions are different rates. So you can account for that to some extent. Weighted parsimony schemes can be used to treat most of the different evolutionary models used with ML, but I think not all of them. I think it's more restrictive. Parsimony throws away information from the non-informative sites, which would actually be informative in maximum likelihood and distance matrix methods. So this is one reason I don't like it very much. It gives little information about branch lengths, okay? And it's been shown to be inconsistent in some cases. There's this thing called the Felsenstein zone, which I'm not going to have time to talk about, really. But there are problems with tree construction methods, and parsimony is subject quite badly to this problem of long branch attraction. So my conclusion, really, is that I can't really see why people use parsimony on molecular data. I mean, it makes sense when you've got qualitative features like morphological features, because there you haven't got a mathematical model, okay? But molecular sequences lend themselves to having a mathematical model, and if you've got one, you might as well use it. Right?
It only works if you believe completely in your model. If your model's right, you should go with it. It only works if the model's right. If the model's wrong, it gives you completely erroneous results.
But you have to make clear that the model
it's not the mathematics behind the model which is important, it's the biological model. Yeah.
You have the same number of assumptions in parsimony. I mean, for example, parsimony still has a model.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you weight all the changes equally, it's like a Jukes-Cantor model, for example. Yeah. And right. So the only advantage to parsimony that I can see is that it's faster. Right. Unless you're using qualitative features where you don't have a model at all. Yeah.
Decent computers should be qualified here too, because if you've got 300 sequences you're trying to work with,
So
you have a problem with maximum likelihood. Yeah. When you use your model, solution.
Yeah. But you can still use maximum likelihood to test. So in fact, I'm going to do that. So if you've got 300 species, you could probably test a few candidate trees. Sure. Okay. Somebody other than Henri. It's a real biologist ought to answer this question. No, that wasn't on the list, so that's a good clue. It wasn't on the original. That's a Saki monkey, which is a new world monkey. That's a pygmygeon. Okay. Right, so now I want to know whether two trees are significantly different from one another. Let's suppose we've got two tree topologies, and we've worked out the maximum likelihood solution for each of those topologies, and we want to know whether one's better than the other. So L1 has a slightly higher likelihood than L2, and we want to know whether it's significantly different. Now, log of the total likelihood is the sum of the log likelihoods over the sites. And if we assume independence of sites, then this is basically, this should have a Gaussian distribution. Basically, we're summing independently evolving sites. So what we can do is we can calculate the distribution of the log likelihoods of the sites for each of the trees, and that gives me two curves which should be Gaussian curves, and the red curve is slightly higher. So log likelihoods are always negative, so they're always minus larger number, so the red curve is slightly less negative than the blue curve, and we can just use standard statistics to tell us whether or not the means are more different than the standard deviations. Okay. So that's called the Kishino-Hasegawa test. And it's used, but it's a little bit dodgy, okay? Because you're assuming the sites are independent, and you're assuming that this fluctuation is coming from randomness as opposed to systematic error, yeah? So there's definitely room for a better statistical test than this. So if somebody comes up with one, then let me know. So should say it works with parsimony as well, because in parsimony this would be the distribution of the scores coming from each site, and you'd do the same thing. Right, so now I want to use maximum likelihood to rank the alternative trees. This is the neighbor joining tree, and we believe this is the correct answer, okay? So this is the topology of the neighbor joining tree, and in fact, there are basically just two uncertain points. So this tree, it has the arrangement with gorilla outside the human-chimp group, yeah? And it has the Lehman and tarsia together, separated from the other primates. So now, what I did was construct alternative trees with different arrangements. So the top one is the neighbor-joining tree, which we believe is the correct one in this case. This one has just it goes the gorilla with the chimp, yeah? This one has the human with the gorilla instead. And then this one has lima outside the tarsia and the other primates, which is what I drew here. Yeah. And this one has the tarsia outside the lima and the other primates. So everything above the question mark there is suggested by the fact that those two bootstrap numbers were low. So I deliberately constructed ones which were slightly different, but they were slightly different in a sensible way. Yeah. Then everything below them, I just made up some other changes below the line there in a more random way. So I swapped, I decided to put human with a pygmy chimp there. Here I put orang and gorilla branching off together, and so on. Yeah. Okay, so you work out log likelihood for each one. You work out the standard deviation, the difference between the two, and then you use the HK test to tell you whether they're worse. And it's fairly bad news in this case. Firstly, the best tree according to maximum likelihood was the second one, which has gorilla and chimp together. And it's only very slightly better than the alternative. So the second best one is this one, one we thought was right in the first place. Very, very slightly worse. All these other ones which I tried due to the... These were the ones that I was seriously interested in, if you like. They're slightly worse, but they're not significantly worse than the best one. And even out of these four, which I thought were definitely wrong, two of those were not significantly worse.
Goldman recently published a kind of nice paper on this, that in fact this test is often badly misused, and in particular, in this case, like by getting, I mean, I'm not sure how you set this up, but very often people will get sort of the answers of these rank differences in trees, and then trying to compare those, you know, the first, the second, the third best tree is actually a really bad misuse of the underlying statistics of the Casino Mezzagala.
Because it's multiple testing, or because of something else?
Yeah, primarily, but yeah, you're searching this really, really large tree space. I mean, the Casino Hasegawa test is specifically set up to compare two pre-formulated hypothesis trees and compare which one is better. So here you're looking at the top of the maximum likelihood space also, and that's part of the problem, is the boundary problem.
Yeah.
Anyway.
If you correct the multiple testing, though, you end up, you make them even less significant.
It's not just a test. Read his paper, it's very interesting, but it's not just a correction.
I don't think this is a very good test, but people do this. And if you like, I was testing ones which had come from that. I could argue that the tested trees were independent of the maximum likelihood criterion, because I chose them based on the neighbor joining and by changing about the bits that I was worried about. Yeah. But I don't want to defend this too strongly. I'm just saying this is the way people often do it, right?
Since this is a mitochondrial tree, and so that doesn't necessarily match the organism trait, how do you know that the neighbor joining tree is actually the correct tree?
I don't know that I... Okay, no, it might not be. Okay. I thought this was the correct... I thought the top one was the correct tree when I picked the species in the first place. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I've seen a classification that put the tarsia with these, for example. Okay? So the position of the tarsia, this point is probably not quite agreed on, yeah? But this is more or less agreed on. I think everybody's decided that this is true now, that humans go with chimps. So that's the same thing with parsimony. With parsimony, it's a different one that comes out the best. The one we thought was correct was the second best again, and it's only one substitution worse than the best one. So in other words, there are a lot of alternatives that are fairly similar. Okay, I'm going to miss that because we're running out of time. There's another way of getting approximate bootstrap numbers, which I'll miss out.
Grasshopper.
Tarsus, that one is. Okay, so now we get to Monte Carlo methods. And I want to say, rather than looking for a single tree, we want to sample over all possible trees with a weighting determined by the likelihood. And that's really because there are a lot of alternatives which are not very different from one another, so it doesn't really make sense to just to pick one and say this is the answer. Okay? So this is very nice for physicists because it's basically just like doing a Monte Carlo simulation of a physical system at a finite temperature. Rather than just looking for the ground state of the system, you're trying to simulate all the green areas there which are accessible likely states at a finite temperature, okay? So it's like the free energy is rather like minus the log likelihood. So you can run a simulation, and it's called the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm in this literature. It's what physicists call the Metropolis algorithm. In other words, you have a configuration, you make a small change to it. If you're going to a more likely configuration, you always accept the move. If you go into a less likely configuration, you accept it with a probability which is the ratio of the likelihoods. That's the Boltzmann factor in the physics analogy, okay? So the move set, the method is defined by the move set, okay? There's changes in the parameters of the rate matrix, there's changes in the branch lengths, and there's changes in the topology. So what you do is you generate an equilibrium sample.
You start from a constructed tree, from a whole tree, or are you growing?
You start from a whole tree.
From a whole tree, and then...
And you make random changes. Mm-hmm. So you might start from the neighbor joining tree, mm-hmm. or you might start from any old random tree. I mean, you hope it doesn't matter where you start from.
Mm-hmm. What's the parameter change in the move set?
The pi's and the alphas in the matrix. I mean, you could...
The rates,
yeah. You could fix them. If you decided you knew that, then you could fix those and then change everything else. Yeah.
Wouldn't changing branch lengths violate the distance you have already calculated?
Well, no, because you're not calculating... So in the first method, you calculate the distances first and then you cluster, right? In this, we don't need to calculate the distance matrix anymore, because we have the probability. So what you have is a probability of getting from one sequence to the other according to a certain branch. Yeah. So the branch lengths are not fixed anymore. They're variables which you're sort of integrating over. Yeah. So this is a Bayesian method. It's saying basically what we've been calculating so far is the likelihood of the data on a given tree I. And maximum likelihood says pick this tree for which the likelihood of the data is the largest. Yeah. Now what we're doing is we're working out the likelihood of the tree I given the data by using this, which is Bayes' theorem. And what we want to know is the value of some observable. Okay. And the observable would be, for example, the probability that Lima and Tarsier come together in a clade like this. Okay. So if I define an observable which is 1 whenever this is true and 0 whenever a different arrangement is true, then I can just do this thing, which is basically how many trees do I sample for which the Lima and Tarsier form a clade. And that's then the posterior probability of that clade occurring. Yeah. Okay. Now, this is the probability of each topology that was seen in a long simulation run. And the top topology has 31% in this case. By the time we get to the sixth topology down here, the cumulative probability is 99%. So there was only 9 topologies that were ever seen in this simulation run. So this is not, I'm not saying this is the complete answer to this problem. This is just one simulation run which was reasonably long, but I'm not sticking too much on these numbers. So the one which was most likely is in fact the neighbor joining topology that we had right from the beginning, which is a little bit strange, because the one which was the maximum likelihood topology was not the neighbor joining, it was number 2 on this. Yeah. So number 2 has the highest maximum likelihood value. That means if I optimize the branch lengths on tree topology number 2, I get a higher value than if I optimize the branch lengths on tree topology number 1. But if I don't fix those things and simulate over the whole distribution, I get a greater weight for this one than that one, okay? It's just one of those things. So it's like, so I think of it as saying it's a broad low peak in competition with a narrow high peak, yeah? And maximum likelihood gives you the narrow high peak, and this gives you the broad low peak. So by sort of, bias is to say that this is the best answer for this data set, but I mean, I don't have a very good argument as to why that is. Yeah. So what I wanted to finish with, maybe. Okay. So on the previous slide, I was showing the probabilities of topologies. And since there were not very many species, I only got 9 different topologies. So I could actually plot a probability of each separate topology. Yeah. So if I had more species, then I would get very, very many topologies. And in fact, it wouldn't be easy to plot the data in that form because there'd be so many different topologies, each one would only have less than 1% probability of occurring. Yeah. So what you can do then is plot the clade probabilities. So what I did here, which would work even if you had very many species, is plot the probabilities of clades occurring. Yeah? So this is the human chimp group. So I've just written it like that. What I mean is there is a clade with human and chimp, and everything else is outside it. Yeah? And we know, in fact, that it's always the gorilla that comes next. Right? But I'm just forgetting that and saying, what's the probability that human and chimp grow together? Yeah? And according to the simulation, it was 56%. According to the bootstrap method, it was 84%. This is what we had a long time ago. Yeah? And according to another method that I missed out, it's 98%. The lemur tarsier was 51% according to this method, 46% according to the other. So those are clades which do occur in the top tree. Yeah? But you can do it for clades which occur in the other tree, clades which occur in any other tree that you wish. You can test any clade that you want. So the gorilla chimp has 43%, and the human gorilla has 1%. So 1 plus 43 plus 56 there makes 100%, hopefully. Yeah? So those three species are rearranging themselves during the simulation, but nothing else is ever coming into that group. Yeah? And then the same goes for... there's the other three uncertain species, which is the arrangement of the tarsier lemur and then the group of the other primates. Yeah, and those are rearranging themselves, but they're not interfering with the rearrangements going down here among the chimp, human, and gorilla. Yeah? So those two things are far apart in the tree, and they're almost independent. So what I would like to understand more is what's the relationship between these numbers and those numbers, because everybody uses these numbers, and what they really would like, I guess, is these numbers.
It seems that the method that you did not explain is more assertive in the sense that large numbers are larger and smaller numbers are smaller.
This is
right?
true. This is a bad method, actually.
It's more assertive.
If you would like, I can explain that. Maybe we've had it. You would like. You want to vote on it? You want me to go back to the slide on that or not? No. Let's leave that. This is the last slide. What's this? It's Homo sapiens. Right. Okay, so that's the end.
Thank you.